Hey, it's Mignon. This is the first of a series of Thursday interview shows that are going to come out for the next couple of months that we're loosely calling Grammar Girl Conversations. I'll talk with my favorite people, authors, dictionary editors, medievalists, and more. Watch for the conversations every Thursday, and I hope you enjoy reveling in the word nerdery as much as I do. Grammar Girl here. I'm Mignon Fogarty, and I'm here with Charles Duhigg, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, author of the bestseller, The Power of Habit, and he's here today to talk about his fabulous new book, Super Communicators. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, we're delighted to have you. So some people are born super communicators, but I was relieved to hear that you can also learn these skills. So what is a super communicator?
So I think we all know super communicators, right? Let me ask you a question. If you were having a bad day and you wanted to call someone who you knew just would just make you feel better, does the person you would call, do you know who that is? Do they pop into your mind?
Yeah.
Yeah, who is it?
Yeah, it's my dad.
Your dad. And yeah. My guess is for everyone listening, someone popped into your mind as well. And for you, your dad is a super communicator. And you're probably a super communicator right back for them. He knows how to ask you the right questions, but he knows how to show you that he's listening and that he cares, that he wants to connect with you.
Actually, what's amazing is I was telling him about your, he did a lot of negotiation when he was in business, and I was telling him about your book, and he said, oh, I do all those things.
like a good dad. He's like, by the way, I know everything you have ever, I do the same thing to my kids. But what's interesting is that there's some people, and your dad is probably one of these, who can do this with literally anyone. Right? They can consistently connect with almost anyone, even when connections are hard, even when we're in a negotiation or we disagree with someone or we don't have anything in common. And these folks are consistent super communicators. And in the last decade, we've learned an enormous amount about them because of advances in neural imaging and data collection. We've learned that it's just a set of skills that they have. It's not something that's inborn to them. It's not something that has to do with their personality. It's just these techniques that when we learn them, help us have conversations and connect with other people.
Yeah. As a former biologist and science writer, one of the things I really liked about your book is that it's all based in science. You're a journalist. You went out and reported this story out. You know, for example, NASA, people think about that as the hard sciences, but they've done a lot of research on communication.
Oh my gosh. And they had to, right? In fact, in the 1980s, there was this push to start building the International Space Station. And NASA suddenly realized, we're about to send people into space for like a year at a time, and they're going to live together in this little tiny can. If they don't have good emotional intelligence, they are going to kill each other, right? It's not going to work out. And so that's one of the things that they did is their head psychologist, a guy named Terry McGuire, he started trying to figure out, how do I test our astronaut candidates to see who has emotional intelligence and who just kind of fakes it really, really well? And it turns out that conversations were the way to do that.
I thought it was hilarious that the astronaut candidates were so good at faking it.
Yeah. And what's interesting is that, so he started this thing where he changed how he did interviews. He would walk into a room and he would spill all these papers as if on accident. And then he would do this big boisterous laugh like, ha, 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 ha. And then pay attention to how the candidate applying to be an astronaut, how they laughed back, because everyone knew you're supposed to laugh back. And some would politely chuckle and go, let me help you with that. And some would match him and go, oh my gosh, that happens to me all the time. Let me give you a hand. And what he knew was that the people who matched him, they were the ones who were showing that they wanted to connect. They were the ones who had emotional intelligence, because showing someone that we want to get to know them better, that is at the core of how we actually connect with them.
Yeah. You know, we talk a lot on the podcast about, you know, dialects and code switching and things like that. And it kind of reminded me of this concept of matching.
Yeah. No, absolutely. In fact, I think code switching is oftentimes a version of matching. And so what matching is, and this is interesting because matching is not mimicry. Mimicry is inauthentic. Mimicry is something that feels like this person's trying to manipulate you. But matching is about recognizing what kind of conversation is happening and trying to align with the other person. So a good example of this is that, you know, it used to be that I would come home from work after a long day and I would complain to my wife. And she would offer me this very practical advice. Like, why don't you, you know, take your boss out to lunch and get to know each other a little bit better. And instead of being able to hear her, I would get even more upset. And I would be like, why aren't you taking my side on this? Why aren't you outraged on my behalf? And when I asked researchers, they said, well, look, you're actually having different kinds of conversations. And so it's very hard to hear each other. You're coming home and you're having an emotional conversation. You're in an emotional mindset. You want to talk about your feelings. And your wife is responding with a practical conversation. And those are both equally legitimate kinds of conversations. But if you're having different kinds of conversations at the same moment, you're not really going to hear each other. You're not going to connect with each other. And so the key is the matching principle in psychology, as it's known, which says that to really communicate with someone, you have to be having the same kind of conversation at the same moment. And then you can move together from different type of conversation to different type of conversation, but you got to get aligned.
It reminded me of another thing we talk about a lot, which is writing to your audience, yeah. Understanding your audience. And it seems like the super communicators do a really good job of understanding their audience and what the audience, their communication partner, needs.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because if I'm coming to you as a science writer, I probably am in a more practical mindset, right? I want you to prove to me that what you're telling me is scientifically valid, that it's rooted in evidence. But if I call up my mom and I talk to her about how nobody understands me and I've had a rough day, I don't want her to be like, well, let me tell you what the science tells you, right? I want her to empathize. I want her to acknowledge my feelings. And I think when we're writing, it's incredibly important to ask ourselves, what does my audience want? Like, why are they picking up this article or this newsletter or podcast or book? What are they looking for? And oftentimes it's more than one thing, right? They want a great story and they want excitement and they want suspense and they want an idea that is rooted in science. And it's when we think about all those different things that we can provide to them that we manage to leap through the page and connect.
Yeah. I realized that was a mistake that I make sometimes in my interpersonal communications. It's like, I'm always bringing the facts.
Right.
I am all about communicating the facts. And that's not always the right approach.
Yeah. Yeah. And sometimes we want those facts, but sometimes we're in a different kind of conversation. And what researchers have found is that there's these three main buckets that our conversations fall into. There's, as I mentioned, the practical, right? We're solving problems. We're sharing facts. There's the emotional, where I describe my feelings and I don't want you to solve my feelings. I want you to empathize. And then there's the social, about how we relate to each other and the social identities we carry. And for instance, politics is a great example of this, because when we have a discussion about politics, sometimes our instinct is to go to the facts, to say like, look, like, you know, taxes went up under your guy, or spending went up, or things got worse. But as we all know, that does not usually work, right? That changes no minds. Rather, it's oftentimes an emotional or a social conversation where we're talking about, I like this guy because this is how he makes me feel. And I feel like I'm frustrated by society and he promises to make it better. Or social, to say like, you know, the way that I bond with other people, my tribe gets behind this issue and that's important to me. And it's when we have that conversation, when we're really talking about the same thing, that we can begin to understand each other much better.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier that matching isn't manipulative. And I had heard of the concept of looping before, but I always felt like it was a little bit manipulative. Like, okay, this is what I hear you saying. But it's much more than that. So I really appreciated how you explained that.
Yeah, and particularly in conversations where there's conflict, this looping for understanding is really, really important. And it has three steps. And you're right. The steps are designed to make it real and not manipulative. And the first step is you just ask a question, right? Preferably a deep question if you can. It's something that gets the other person to talk a little bit about their values or their beliefs or their experiences. Then step number two, repeat back in your own words what you just heard them say. And that in your own words is really, really important. Because I'm not trying to mimic you. I'm not trying to parrot you. What I'm trying to do is show you that I've paid attention, that I've processed what you're telling me, that I'm really grabbing onto it. And then the third step is to ask you if I got it right, to give me permission to acknowledge that I understood you, that I listened closely. And the reason why this is powerful is because it proves that I'm listening to you. And when someone proves that they're listening to us, we trust them more, we like them more, we become more willing to listen to them in return. But equally, if I do this honestly, it means I don't have to change my opinion. I don't have to be manipulative and pretend I believe something I don't. I might loop for understanding and understand exactly what you're saying and still completely disagree with you. But what's important is I've processed what you told me on your terms. I've shown you that I process it, that I listen closely. And then I'm in a place where I can say, look, I actually see the world differently, but it's so helpful to understand you. And I hope that you'll take the time to understand me.
A big part of the book is about asking questions, asking better questions. Maybe explain how people can just tweak the kinds of questions they ask just a little bit to become better communicators. Yeah.
It's a great question. And particularly for writers, I think the ability to ask the right questions is really powerful. So one of the things that we know is that consistent super communicators, people who can connect with almost anyone, they tend to ask a lot more questions than the average person, like 10 to 20 times as many questions. And some of those questions are like, we hardly even register them as questions. They're things like, oh, what'd you think about that? Or, well, what'd you say next? Right? They're inviting us into the conversation. But some of the questions are what are known as deep questions. I mentioned this before. And a deep question is something that invites us to talk about our values or our beliefs or our experiences. And that can sound kind of daunting, but it's actually much easier and much less invasive than it sounds like. For instance, if you meet someone who's a lawyer, you might say, instead of saying, where do you practice law? You might say, oh, you know, what made you decide to go to law school? Or what's the best case you ever worked on? What do you like about being a lawyer? Those are all deep questions. They're very easy to ask, but they're deep questions because when that person responds, they're going to tell you about the experiences that they had that led them to law school, about what they love about their job, the values that they bring to their work every day, and how they're able to make good on their beliefs. That's really powerful. And when someone reveals that to you, when they say something real and meaningful, if we respond in kind, if we engage in what's known as reciprocal authenticity or reciprocal vulnerability, then we're actually creating a bond with them. And again, we might come from completely different worlds, but if I say, oh, that's why you went to law school, it's interesting. I went to medical school because I saw my uncle get sick when I was a kid. Now suddenly we have this thing in common that allows us to form a real connection.
Yeah, you're mentioning reciprocity. Made me think of this part of the book where there's this famous study with these famous 36 questions or something like that that a lot of people may have heard of, the questions that make you fast friends for life. But what you had in there that I didn't know is that it was also really important to take turns.
Yes, it's critical to take turns. So for folks who aren't familiar with this, sometimes these are called the 36 questions that lead to love. And what these researchers did, Arthur and Elaine Aaron, is they brought these strangers in two by two, and they would give them this list of questions to ask and answer between the two of them. And then, and this is pre-internet, this is like the early 90s, then they just sent everyone home. They didn't give anyone contact information, nothing like that. And then 7 weeks later, they followed up and they found that almost 60% of the people who had participated in the study, they went and they searched out the person that they had done this exercise with, right? One guy said something like, you know, I knew that his name was John and his last name started with S. So I called every John S in the white pages until I found him.
Oh my gosh.
Three couples ended up getting married who met this way. And the reason why is exactly what you just said, is that when we have a real conversation, when we answer questions that are meaningful and that expose something about ourselves, and most importantly, when we engage in reciprocity, I ask you, you answer, and then you ask me, and we feel like we're sharing equally with each other and we're sharing things that matter, we just feel closer to each other. We like each other more. A stranger becomes someone that we're going to go through the white pages to find because we had the right conversation with them.
And a lot of this is about speaking to each other, yeah. Verbal communication. But you had a section about communicating online, which is, you know, we lose all those tools. We have the laugh, like, are we laughing the same? You just lose that when you're communicating online. And, you know, one of the things was like, you just cannot be too polite, like crank up the politeness. But what else?
Well, it's fascinating. What they found, and there's been study after study that's done this, is if you look at people just like screaming at each other online and one person starts saying please and thank you, the entire temperature will lower by about 50% and people will stop screaming at each other. This is what we know. We know that different forms of communication require slightly different rules. And all of us already know this, right? One of my favorite examples of this is that about 100 years ago, when telephones first became popular, there were all these studies that said people will never be able to have real conversations over the phone because you can't see each other. And at the moment, they were actually right. If you listen to, if you read the transcripts of early phone conversations, it's people using it like a telegram, giving each other shopping lists or stock orders. But of course, by the time we were teenagers, we could talk on the phone for like 7 hours a night. And what happened is that we learned how to use telephones. We learned that there's special rules for telephones. Without even being aware of it, when you and I talk on the phone, we over-enunciate our words. We put more emotion into our voice because we know the person can't see us. And when it comes to online dialogue, which is usually written, the same thing is true. There are special rules for different forms of communication. And when we get into trouble is when we forget to pay attention to those rules, when we forget to remind ourselves that a text is different from an email, is different from talking to someone on the phone. But if we do remind ourselves and we say like, oh, they're not going to be able to hear the sarcasm in my voice, so maybe I shouldn't be sarcastic, or maybe I should put a bunch of emojis to sort of show the emotions I'm feeling alongside these words, that's when that communication becomes better. That's when we're able to connect, even if we can't see each other.
You have said that writing this book was a learning experience for you as you were working on it. And I would just love to hear how it has changed your work as a journalist, as a reporter.
Yeah. You know, I think as a reporter, so I write for the New Yorker magazine right now. I used to write for the New York Times, and I report these books. They're kind of like the same reporting projects as my newspaper and magazine work. And I think I used to feel like my job as a reporter was just to ask questions, not to insert myself into the conversation, but to interview the other person. And one of the things I really carried away from this is, in order for a conversation to happen, both people have to bring themselves to it, right? Even though I'm asking someone about their research and their findings and you know, my experiences aren't going to show up in the article, if I share my experiences, if I react to what they're telling me with my own feelings and my own thoughts, then what that source is telling me is going to become so much richer. And so oftentimes now what I find myself doing is I'll call someone up and I'll ask them some questions and they'll mention something. You know, I got interested in this because one of my kids got sick. And I'll ask questions about like, what was it like to have a sick kid? Because I've had sick kids and like, I know how scary it is. And I know you go into the hospital and like, you feel totally overwhelmed. Like what was it like for you when you went into a hospital as a scientist? And suddenly they tell me these things that are so much richer, so much more meaningful. The goal of a conversation in a lot of ways, and this is true of interviews too, is to surprise ourselves by what we say. That's where new ideas come from, is we speak them to someone else and we say, oh, those words just came out of my mouth and I never thought about it that way before. And that's exciting, and that's reporting and journalism. And so I try and bring myself to these conversations, ask deep questions, engage in this vulnerability and authenticity reciprocation, prove that I'm listening. The same things that we do in a conversation are the things that make an interview magical.
Wonderful. Well, you know, I think this is a really important book. You know, as I was reading it, I was thinking, I need to get this for every, you know, 22-year-old in my life. And imagine, you know, if I had known these things when I graduated from college and entered the workforce, life would have been a lot smoother. The book is Super Communicators by Charles Duhigg. I encourage you all to read it. And thank you, Charles, so much for being here with us today.
Thank you for having me on. This has been such a delight.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Charles Duhigg. I'll be back with our regular Tuesday episode, including a fun segment about the origin of punctuation and some useful advice for fixing noun clusters. And make sure to check back here next Thursday for our next installment of Grammar Girl Conversations.